Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 29, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss religious liberties and whether an exemption under ERISA for churches extends to nonprofit hospitals and schools. This is a case that was argued Monday, and we're very pleased to welcome our guest today who attended oral argument. I'm Dean Reuter, General Counsel, Vice President, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome from the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberties, Eric Baxter, where he is senior counsel. Should note that the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberties filed an amicus brief in this case. And as I mentioned at the outset, Mr. Baxter was able to attend oral argument on Monday. He's going to give us some background on the case and let us know what happened. With that, the floor is yours, Eric Baxter.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you to any listeners. It's a privilege to share with you the facts of this case and some of the experience at oral argument, the reaction of the justices to the arguments. It's a bit of a sleeper case. The name of the case is Advocate Health versus Stapleton, and it's an ERISA case involving the interpretation of church plans under ERISA. It's been a bit of a sleeper case. ERISA is not exactly known for attracting large crowds. In fact, it was paired on Monday at the Supreme Court with a patent venue case. So I assume that there might not be a lot of people in the lawyer's line to get in, and went a little later than I had originally anticipated and was lucky to make it in. It turned out that there are a lot of people who are interested in this case, and I think it's because it involves significant issues about defining a church under the law, and in this specific case there are also enormous consequences and potentially billions of dollars in damages that could go to the class action plaintiffs who initiated the cases in the district court. So I hope today that my remarks will shed some light on the case and that I will be able to share some of the more entertaining aspects of the case in the process. Churches were some of the first organizations in the United States to provide pension plans for their employees. And so when Congress enacted ERISA and its comprehensive regulatory scheme of pension plans in 1974, it intentionally left church plans out, perhaps out of respect for the strong record of church plans in providing benefits that were well-funded and that through today continue to be better benefits and better funded than the industry standard. And also, I think, to avoid the entanglement that would be obvious if the government were trying to regulate the church's internal affairs of how it paid its employees. As originally enacted, the exemption, the church plan exemption in what I'll refer to as subsection A of the relevant provision, defined a church as a church plan as a plan that is both established and maintained for the employees of a nonprofit church or convention of churches. And that phrase, established and maintained, is really what's at issue in this case. A separate provision, subsection C, provided that existing plans that were established and maintained by a church could continue to cover both church employees and employees of church agencies like hospitals, at least until 1982. So there were many plans, churches that had hospitals or other agent mission boards, other independent agencies whose employees were covered under the church plan, and Congress said they would allow that through 1982. About 3 years after ERISA's enactment in 1977, the IRS issued an opinion letter to two orders of Catholic sisters who had approached the IRS to confirm that their hospital pension plans were church plans under the law. And the IRS ruled against them, holding that because their principal activity was operating hospitals and not performing sacerdotal functions or conducting worship, that they did not qualify as a church. The IRS recognized that they did perform some sacraments, they engaged in scripture readings and prayers with their patients, but held that that was not sufficient to qualify them as what the IRS considered a true church. This caused fairly widespread consternation among the religious community. They objected to the IRS, assuming that it could define what and what is not a part of a church. For most churches, practicing what they preach is at least equally important to what they preach on the weekends. And so there was concern that the IRS would be saying that nuns were not part of the church, but a Catholic bishop was. It also triggered a new concern that hadn't really seen a lot of attention to that point, that this idea of established and maintained by a church might be a problem for conventions of churches especially, or other groups that created separate pension boards that were independent from the church, independently incorporated but still controlled by the church, to run their pension plans. And so there was concern that whether these pension boards would constitute being established by the church. So it's important to understand the different ways that church plans could be operated. A church could itself establish and maintain internally a plan. It could, as I mentioned, set up an external pension board that would establish and maintain the plan. Or it sometimes would establish a plan internally and then transfer it to the pension board to run the plan and carry out the operations over the course of the rest of the plan's existence. So those two concerns, this concern that, you know, IRS is trying to tell the churches who belongs to the church and who doesn't, and then this concern that pension boards might not be covered, if you read the plan, the language literally, caused a lot of consternation, and the number of denominations representing, you know, millions of members approached Congress and said, we need a fix. And so in 1980, and the IRS letter, IRS was also aware that there was a problem. It was likely concerned about this role that it had then in defining churches, at least the way it read the statute. And so in 1980, Congress, in response to all of that, passed the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act, which recognized that church agencies are essential to church's mission and who they are, and that ERISA, the church plan exemption as originally written, was too narrowly drawn and did not really cover the actual way that church plans were organized and operated in the real world. So the amended law left the original subsection A in place, that a church plan is a plan established and maintained by a nonprofit church. It amended subsection C and eliminated the sunset provision that said you could cover church agency employees only until 1982 and replaced it with a much broader provision. And it did that by saying that the original plans established and maintained by a church would include a plan maintained by an organization, the principal purpose of which was to run a pension plan. These were called principal purpose organizations. As long as those independent boards, those pension boards, were controlled by or associated with the church, meaning that they share common religious bonds and convictions. There were also additional provisions added that said that employees of churches would include employees of any organization that shared these common religious bonds and convictions, and that the church in turn would be deemed the employee of those employees. So there was kind of a both ways. The employees would be, even though they're employees of a hospital, as long as that hospital had common religious bonds and convictions with the church, they would be considered employees of the church, and the church would be considered their employer. So this language, to my mind, pretty clearly established that religious hospitals and other religious agencies were entitled to use church plans to provide benefits to their employees. And that's clear if you think about the three main ways that those plans were established and maintained. It's clear that plans established and maintained by a house of worship or a traditional church were still clearly covered, whether they had an internal pension board or an external pension board. That was clear from the effort to get rid of the 1982 sunset provision. It's also clear that a house of worship or traditional church, if it established a plan but then turned it over to its agency, or let's say that the agency, the hospital or whatever it would be, later spun off as a separate entity, it's clear that those are also covered, even if it's those plans just cover agency employees, because the plan was established by a church And the law says that plans established and maintained by a church include plans maintained by these pension boards. And that's often what happens, that you have these pension boards that are spun off or they're independently maintaining the plans. The problem in this case was where is what happens if the church agency, the hospital, itself directly established and maintained, and the church as a separate entity, the house of worship, was never really involved. And that's what happened with the nuns in 1997, who had formed the church, created the pension plan, and maintained it all throughout its existence. That was really the question where the IRS denied it. The class action lawyers in this case have seized upon the amended language to say that there still is a church establishment requirement, that the language established and maintained by a church includes plans maintained by a pension board, excludes plans that were established by a pension board. So they would say it's okay for a church to establish the plan and turn it over, but not for the pension boards to establish the plan themselves from the beginning. To support this argument, they used a couple of hypotheticals. One, they would say, well, if you had a statute that gave benefits to someone who is disabled and a veteran, and it was amended to say disabled and, you know, someone who is disabled and a veteran includes a member of the National Guard, you wouldn't say that every member of the National Guard gets the benefits. They would still have to show a disability. Or if you said, you know, eligibility for president, you have to be 35 and be a natural born citizen, and it was amended to say that a natural born citizen, someone who's 35 and a natural born citizen includes someone born abroad on a U.S. military base to parents who are citizens, that wouldn't eliminate the age requirement. They also argued that allowing that under the religious hospital's reading, churches can directly establish, maintain their plans, but agencies cannot because they have to use a pension board. The plan says that only if there's a pension board running it. So you could have a church that establishes and maintains internally, but agencies are required to do it through a board, and they see that as some kind of an anomaly that Congress couldn't have intended. And finally, they argue that the main purpose was to avoid going through the church's books and records, and so there shouldn't be, they wouldn't have been concerned about regulating agencies who don't have the same, they argued, wouldn't have the same right to keep the government out of their books and records. But the religious hospital's responses to those questions really seemed rather devastating. They pointed out that the phrase elected and or established and maintain, established really has no independent meaning. There's nothing in the statute that says what it means to establish a plan, that maintaining is where the work is really done. The organization maintaining it has the obligation to fund it, to make sure the payments are made properly and timely, has the fiduciary obligations. And so the establishment requirement has really no independent significance. So it would be like saying that if, you know, the phrase in the Constitution that to be someone elected to and served in the Senate includes a person, if you added it to say includes a person who served in the House, you wouldn't say that the elected to the Senate provision had independent meaning. It's clearly just trying to substitute in all these plans to receive all the same benefits that the originally protected plans received. And the hospitals also pointed out that the anomalies under the class actions reading are much more problematic. It doesn't really matter if you're forcing hospitals and administrators to fund their plans or to run their plans through a board instead of internally, because that's what happens anyway. Everyone always establishes some kind of a pension board to run the plans. It's usually not the bishop or the head of the organization that's there making the decisions. There's an independent entity set up to run these. So while there may be a gap in the religious hospital's reading of the law, it's a gap that has no real world significance. And so it really shouldn't, it's easy to see how it might have slipped through Congress's thinking. But if you adopted the classes reading, the anomalies are much greater. It doesn't make sense, for example, why you would let a church establish a plan and then pass it off to an agency like a hospital, but not let the agency just establish it in the first place, since establishing has no real independent significance. And everyone agrees that hospitals that have a plan established by a church but maintained by the hospital can cover just hospital employees. And so there's no reason why you would, you know, if hospitals can cover just for their employees and maintain those plans under a church plan, why do you care whether the church stepped in the first place? And then the biggest problem is that the class action lawyers' reading of the plan would have left out a major group that Congress was clearly trying to protect, and that is conventions of churches that join together to create plans and so set up separate independent boards to run those plans. And those were in place from the very beginning and was one of the main concerns that prompted the amendment to the law. And the class didn't really have an answer to how they would respond to that. There were the justices were very engaged. There were a lot of questions on both sides. Ultimately, I felt like the church plans, the religious hospitals held the upper hand, even with some of the justices who were more skeptical. Sotomayor, for example, at the beginning questioned how these hospitals that are, you know, she said, aren't they very similar to a for-profit hospital? They, you know, there's some of the, one of them is the fifth largest medical care provider in the country. They're competing against for-profit entities. Why should they be exempt? And that question is still actually live in the lower courts because there is the requirement that the agency has to have a common religious bond or conviction with the church, and that has not been resolved in any of the cases. And Sotomayor later seemed to be swayed by this idea that, you know, if the nuns went in 1977 and were denied a church plan by the IRS, all of the churches and the IRS went to Congress and said, how do we, you know, you have to fix this. Congress amended the law, and the next thing that happened was IRS turned around, and the very first letter it granted a church plan to was these same two groups of nuns. And Sotomayor seemed persuaded that it's, you know, that's, she said, you know, isn't that obvious that IRS understood this, and that would have been a good indication of what Congress intended so quickly after this happened. And the lawyer for the class said, you know, I can't deny that that's how they interpreted it. And the fact is that's been going on for 37 years since then, that three agencies, IRS, Department of Labor, and the Public Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which insures pension plans under ERISA, all of those agencies for nearly 40 years have been interpreted the same way as the IRS. And so there was a lot of question about why they shouldn't give deference to the agencies. There was also a great line of questioning when Alito pounced on the attorney for the lawyers, for the class, and said, you know, isn't this going to create tremendous liability, 30 years of reliance, and now you're asking for, you know, what the hospitals have said is $60 billion in fees just from the plaintiffs in the case. And the attorney arguing for the class really stumbled at this point and said, you know, this is really a forward-looking case. We're just trying to make sure that employees get their benefits when they're supposed to get them. We're not really looking at fees. And Alito said, well, is it true or not that there are billions of dollars in penalties alleged in the complaint? The attorney said, well, we don't actually name a figure. Alito said, well, if you add it up, what would it be? And, you know, the attorney kind of stumbled again. And then so Alito just said, well, are you willing on behalf of your clients to disavow any request for penalties? And the attorney said, no, I'm not. And the courtroom just erupted in laughter because everyone could see that, you know, the class action is obviously there to get fees and to argue they're really just in this to make sure that there's future benefits for employees was really laughable. And there were instances with the other justices. I've spoken my 15 minutes, but I'm happy to answer questions about the other justices' reaction. But overall, I felt like the religious hospitals really laid out a clear case, not only on the statutory construction, but on deference to the agencies and the reliance that for 40 years everyone has thought that this ERISA never applied to these plans, and it would create enormous disruption to go back on that now.
Very good. Thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. If you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We got plenty of time left for your questions. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me make an announcement about the next coming Teleform conference call. That's going to be Friday. I think we're dark tomorrow, at least as scheduled right now, so the next Teleform conference call will be scheduled for Friday. Just to get things started here, again, in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button. How well attended was the argument, and how would you describe, I mean, to the extent you can, the did you get an overall sense of the skepticism of the court for one side or the other, or for the room for one side or the other? And was this a particularly engaged argument? Were the justices on top of one side or the other, sort of in an adversarial way from the outset?
Great question. So as far as attendance, I was actually surprised how many people were there. For those of you who have been in the Supreme Court and attended an argument, you know that unless you're arguing for a party or are being admitted that day, even if you're admitted to the bar of the Supreme Court, you have to get in a line and see if there's room for you to be admitted. And I thought, well, there probably won't be that many people. This case was paired with a pension or a patent venue case, was the other case being heard that day. So I went a little later than I normally might have, and just ended up getting in. And the line behind me was all the way to the back door. So there was a lot of interest, a surprising amount of interest. And I think because there are a lot of church plans, there are a lot of attorneys who work on the church plans, and they know the huge consequences that are at stake in this case. And so it did generate quite a bit of interest. The courtroom was packed as it always is, and the line, the public line, also seemed larger than I expected it to be. The arguments, as far as the justices' reaction, the arguments started out. I thought that the Justice Sotomayor, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Kagan, and Kennedy to a lesser extent, but they asked pretty hard questions of Lisa Blatt, the attorney for the religious hospitals. And we're kind of pushing her on why should these organizations that look very secular on the outside, why should they be given an exemption under the church plan? But when the class lawyer spoke, I got a much stronger sense that the more of the justices were against him. Kagan jumped in with some questions. She was concerned, about this idea that church pension boards, where the board established and maintained the plan. She said, they were the quintessential group that Congress was trying to make sure was protected, and under the class's reading, you'd be left out. And the class really had no reaction to that. Justice Sotomayor went on for quite some time saying, the whole thing that triggered this, the amendment, was the IRS's rejection of the nuns' plan as a church plan, and right after the amendment passed, the IRS came in and let them be a church plan. She seemed to see that was a very clear indication of what had got on. Justice Kennedy asked a lot of questions about, the fees and the reliance on that, and how Justice Kennedy and Alito both pounced on the fee issue and how the penalties, the reliance on the agency. Justice Breyer was a latecomer, as he often is, on the questions, and just toward the very end of the class lawyer's argument, he wanted to know, how many employees would actually come under ERISA that haven't for the last 40 years because of the church plan exemption. And Feldman, the attorney, said, well, I would assume all of them. There's a million employees in these plans. And then he said, there's going to be millions more if you rule against me. Everybody's going to become a church plan. And Breyer said, well, how can that be? Because, and he actually raised one of Beckett's clients. He said, unless you're the Little Sisters of the Poor, there's still that common religious bonds and convictions requirement. And so a lot of people can't just fake their way into a church plan. They have to show a common bond, religious bond and conviction with a denomination or something like that. And Feldman said, well, these aren't all Little Sisters of the Poor. And Breyer pointed out, well, that's going to be decided below. But he said, I want to know if a church establishes a plan and the Little Sisters of the Poor maintain it, is it exempt or not? And the attorney said that they're exempt. And Breyer said, well, if the Little Sisters establish it and maintain it themselves, are they exempt or not? And Feldman said, well, they're not exempt if the church didn't establish it. And Breyer, it was a little confusing, but he seemed to be getting this idea as why this inconsistency. Who cares if the Little Sisters are the ones who are running it? What is the difference does it make if they started it on their own or got a bishop to sign off somewhere, whatever established means, which a lot of justices also pressed on that. Like, what does it even mean to establish a plan? And there was no clear answer to that. And then Breyer said, well, if the Little Sisters are a legitimate, or if an organization is a legitimate religious organization like the Little Sisters, they're really affiliated with the church, they have a lot of involvement, And Feldman, I think, made a big stumble here where he said, well, if they really are part of the church, and Breyer interrupted and said, yes, they are, which I thought was interesting. And Feldman said, well, if they do, they might qualify as a church, and that's fine. And Roberts jumped in and pounced on him and said, hey, I thought the whole purpose was to avoid that inquiry of how do you draw a line between the nuns and the bishops and so forth. That was the very mistake the IRS had made in saying that they're not actually part of the church. So by the end, I thought Feldman made several missteps in kind of conceding that there was this problem with line drawing, that his arguments wouldn't fix, the problem with the church's own pension boards, that his interpretation wouldn't fix. And so I felt like, you know, Sotomayor, Breyer, Kennedy, Alito, Thomas, and Rob, and Chief Roberts were all ultimately seemed to favor the religious organizations.
We do have a couple questions pending at this point. Let me ask a follow-up question really quickly. I think you can get to this. The 1977 IRS opinion letter that was adverse, that was reversed. When it was reversed, did the IRS specifically cite the 1980 amendments, or did they just reverse it without citing it?
They just reversed without citing, and they did stamp on it, you know, this is non-precedential and this is not binding. And the class lawyers made a lot of that, saying, well, you know, these aren't even binding. They're not really, don't really have any significance. And Robert said, yeah, but every opinion letter from a government agency has that. Isn't that just standard? And Feldman acknowledged, yes, that's just standard. And several of the justices seem to, you know, there's been hundreds of these letters since 1980. And the tenor I got from the justices was that if the IRS was so closely involved in this amendment, they had come in against it initially with their 1977 letter. They lost the fight, and they seemed to know they lost the fight and came right out and started doing what has been done for the last 40 years. And so the Sotomayor and Kennedy especially seemed to see that as they didn't want to get into the legislative history, but that the context and the historical backdrop seemed to make clear that everybody knew that's what Congress had done.
Very good. We've got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, thank you for today, first off. But I was curious, in while you're listening to the arguments, what, if at all, the expanded breadth of the decision may have outside of just churches and hospitals, but religious nonprofits in general. You know, what is the required link there to the church to where this may apply? Would you see this as potentially an expansion or just clarifying what's been argued below?
Yeah, what I anticipate is that the court is just going to give, I really think, although the, you know, statutory language is somewhat complex and is hard to convey in a conversation, when you really dig in and look at what each of the provisions does, that all employees of church agencies are considered church employees, that the church is considered their employer, and that creating this special rule for pension boards, it seems, the language actually to me seems quite strong in favor of the religious organization. So I wouldn't be surprised if the court just issued a very straightforward decision interpreting the statute and leaving it that. They didn't talk much other than Justice Breyer's comments and Roberts' comment about line drawing. They didn't get much into the constitutional concerns about, you know, how much who gets to decide what a church is? Is it, can you say that a church is just an organization that engages in worship and sacraments? Or do you have to recognize that church's good works are also part of the church? They didn't spend a lot of time on that. And they didn't spend a lot of time on, you know, the church autonomy issues as far as how much the government can look into church books and records and things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if they just rely on the statutory construction argument. And it was, they made pretty clear that they all understood that this issue of how closely you have to be aligned to the church is still an issue that's live in the lower courts. So showing the common bonds and convictions is not a well-developed question. And so that's something that in each of these cases, if it's remanded for further proceedings, that will still be an issue. So I think that's where you'll see the real, you could see some real interesting case law come out of what it means to be to share common bonds and convictions with the church.
Once again, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. After that, our lines will be wide open. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Gary Wheaton up in New Hampshire again. I haven't heard the I don't know if those hearings are online yet or not, but did the justices ask any questions, in your opinion, that could lead you to believe that they were trying to form opinions for future pending cases on religion? In other words, how do you think their decision or their questioning would affect any future, for example, Hobby Lobby type cases, contraception? Was there anything like that in there? Was there any lemon test issues involved in their questioning?
I think the main question that really brought that out was surprisingly from Justice Breyer. I thought it was telling that he seemed so irritated when Feldman questioned whether the Little Sisters of the Poor were part of the church. His response was like, well, yes, they are part of the church, and you're going to have to deal with that. So I think that was interesting that he recognized that, and maybe that tells us something about how he would rule in future cases where there's effort to kind of divide churches, formal churches, houses of worship, from other types of church agencies. And Alito, clearly, as he has in a lot of religious liberty cases, is clearly very protective of religious liberty and concerned about who gets to decide what is not a church, and Roberts as well. So I think there's a possibility that they could make some statements, depending on who writes the opinion, about the caution, at least, with which the church, with which the court must address these issues. It may, a constitutional avoidance argument, I could see that coming into play. We're saying, even though we've ruled this way on the statutory language, our ruling is further enforced by our, desire to avoid questions, getting into questions of how we define what a church is and things like that.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm encouraged by the Breyer question as well. Thanks.
Our lines are now wide open. If you have a question, this is the time to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if we get a final question. Let me ask, if you know, to the extent you know, whether the government, U.S. government, filed a brief in this case, and if they did, whether their position changed with the change in the administration.
So yes, the government did file a brief in support of the pension, in support of the religious agencies. It did not change. It was supporting the religious agencies from the beginning and did not change with the administration. They took a very strong position that this was a clear understanding from the beginning, and they supported the statute, the religious hospital statutory interpretation, their reliance arguments, and the whole bit. They also had some time at argument, and the attorney who argued for the Solicitor General's argument gave, strong support for the religious hospitals.
And did the government attorney field any tough questions from the bench?
The hypothetical questions that had been raised in the briefs were mostly aimed at him. Why couldn't Congress have been more clear? And part of that response was, they weren't working from a clean slate. They were working from the pre-existing law, and so it wasn't unusual to take the original definition and just say, this is going to include. He pointed out, I made an interesting argument, the original, at one point the amendment said that plans established and maintained by a church includes plans both established and maintained by a pension board, and that second established was removed. And so there was a lot of questioning about why did they, remove that, because that would have made clear that plans established by a benefit board were included. And he pointed out that it would have fixed that problem, but it would have created another problem in that it would have excluded plans that are established by a church and transferred to a pension board for maintenance, and that was a bigger problem.
Right.
And so he did a good job of it. They were very technical questions, and he was able to address them well.
Very good. Let me make a final call for questions. Our lines are wide open. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Well, Mr. Baxter, it seems as though we've had our final question. Well, no, here we have one more question. Let's open line to this new caller. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, my name is Wesley Hengbui from Rice University, student. I'd like to ask, with the impending nomination of Judge Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, what do you see as that impact on this case, future cases, as well as for the healthcare industry in general? Thank you very much.
Well, we at Beckett are very optimistic about the Gorsuch nomination. He's obviously a very well-qualified judge. He just happens to have ruled in a number of cases that we've participated in, the Little Sisters of the Poor case, the Hobby Lobby case in the Tenth Circuit, the Yellow Bear case involving a Native American prisoner, all cases that we either represented parties or participated as amici. And so I think he wrote excellent opinions in all of those cases that show a sophisticated and, in our view, correct understanding of the religious liberty principles at issue. And so I suspect that he would have shared some of the same concerns that Alito showed and Justice Roberts showed on the court. You know, it's hard to say, of course, but I'm optimistic that he would been on the side of a ruled in favor of the religious hospitals. I don't really know. My understanding is that sometimes if a case is divided 4-4 and there is a pending nomination to fill the ninth spot, that the court has had rehearing after the justice is finally confirmed to allow that justice to vote on the case and break the tie. But again, I'm perhaps being optimistic, but I think that that's not going to happen here. It won't be necessary.
I'll make another call for a final question. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Now, it does seem, Eric Baxter, as though we've gotten our final question in. We do have some time left. Let me give you a minute or two to express a final thought or wrap up. Anything you want to add?
Sure. I would just, you know, the Beckett brief really focused on this idea that you can't define churches by worship and sacraments. That, you know, there's a huge range of churches. They have different polities. They have different practices. For some churches, their emphasis on works is greater than their emphasis on religious services. There are congregational churches where you have pastors or fathers or sisters who have gone out and as their mission started hospitals, started schools, started mission programs, and that all of those are just as much a church as the house of worship. And in fact, the term church itself is a term that is not used widely outside of Christianity. It's not used in much in, you know, Islam or Judaism or Sikhism, Hinduism. And really should be understood as any religious organization that engages in sincere religious exercise. And so to the extent that the court reaches the religious question, our hope is that they will clarify the broad meaning of church and the significance that that has for a wide diversity of religious organizations.
Very good. Well, Eric Baxter, my thanks to you personally and on behalf of the Federalist Society. We certainly appreciate you attending oral argument, but also coming to us with these insights and special information. Thank you so much. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your participation in our call today. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call will be looking at the Fairness and Class Action Litigation legislation Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.